Spring is having trouble getting started this year. In fact, it still feels like winter outside. But anglers are thinking about getting to the stream sides and out on the water to fish. A lot of rivers are still icy or high and muddy, and lakes around Anchorage are largely frozen, but you can fish on the ocean for halibut or king salmon, and in a few weeks, fishermen will be off to the races. I'm Charles Wolforth. Today on Outdoor Explorer, we'll be talking about what to expect this summer and everything else about fishing in South Central Alaska. How will this cold spring affect the fishing season? My guests are expert anglers from the north and south ends of Cook Inlet and a biologist who can give us the science perspective, and we welcome your comments and questions too. You can comment through our website at alaskapublic.org or on our Outdoor Explorer page at Facebook. And our guest in the studio with me is Tony Weaver. He writes the fishing column at the Anchorage Daily News. I've got that linked on our website, alaskapublic.org. He's started for the season already, although not too much to talk about yet, right, Tony?
Well, I was pushing it.
Yeah.
We're pushing it.
And he's also an experienced broadcaster. He has his own fishing radio show that you can tune into twice a week on another station. And also in the studio, or on the phone with me, is Jim Lervakis from Homer. He's a charter captain, a fishing expert, photographer. We've got links to his company, Skookum Charters, and his book that he's recently come out with, Snap Decisions. Thanks for being with us, Jim.
Oh, you're welcome, Charles.
And also in the studio, Tom Vania, who is a regional management biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, covering Cook Inlet. And really glad to have you with us today, Tom.
Yeah, thanks, Charles.
So I think everybody is talking about the weather and the fact that it is just freezing cold outside. We have a few sunny days here and there, but then you know, a lot of cold, wet weather, and that has got to, it's obviously going to affect the onset of fishing when there's still ice in the rivers and lakes, but how does it affect run timing and other factors with fishing through the summer?
Yeah, right now we know king salmon, they're not real fond of real cold water temperatures there in the river. I believe that the ocean temperatures are a little more average and normal right now, but with really cold water coming out of the rivers, they may tend to hold up out in the ocean a little bit longer. We are a little bit behind in getting some weir projects and sonar projects into the water. We're still dealing with some areas that are still frozen up. Camps are frozen up. Some shellfish there. So we are a little bit behind in those. But again, hopefully right now there's not a lot of fish moving into the river right now. So we're probably not missing much right now, assessment-wise.
Yeah.
The Kenai is Lower Kenai sonar project is set to go for today. They are in the lower river, and they are working in on an upriver site as well to get that in and get that going as well.
Now, when would that early run of kings normally get rolling down the Kenai, and would it be possible to say, well, they might be a week late, or is that just sort of too fine-grained of a prediction to make?
Yeah, right now it's kind of early to say, but May 16th is when that project traditionally begins. Mm-hmm. So they are in, they are ready to go. As far as run timing goes, we'll have to see as it develops. The Anchor Rivers, they're working on their weir down there as well. They did have some channel moved on them a little bit, so they are having to kind of modify that site location a little bit to get that one going as well.
So presumably, this is when you're putting the weirs in. This is when you expect at least the first few fish to be coming along, or?
Yeah, typically our projects get in, you know, as soon as we can, and salmon, when they return, you know, they kind of return on a bell-shaped curve, you know. So we're at the beginning of of the run, you know. So we're really not missing anything right now, as Tony probably can attest to.
Well, Tony, we were talking about how your column. You didn't have much to write about this week because there's still ice or high water.
Most of our roadside stuff here, which is probably the most popular, you know, part of you know, the majority of anglers in Alaska. You know, we're just, you know, we're running behind schedule. I mean, we got a lot of ice still, and I know that Tom and the guys are probably, you know, really under the gun here and getting this stuff in. But you know, I took a little drive down the road here last week, and then I was down the road. Actually, I went down to Seward on Saturday, And, you know, there's just the lakes are all still frozen over. I mean, you know, there's some leading edges that are open up, but we're behind schedule. So, you know, just be patient. Just the thing I always tell guys is that, you know, the earth starts tilting closer to the sun. So we cannot be denied. Eventually we will get warmer.
Yeah.
It's just the duration and how much of that we're going to experience, you know.
Hopefully spring starts by solstice this year, right?
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah.
Yeah. So, are you seeing this down there, Jim?
Yeah, let me just interject here. So we had snow on the ground here this morning for a very short while, and they're saying we'll have more snow overnight. But I had two good reports of, fish of size, 40 pounder and a 45 pounder being caught up off of Anchor Point. And what the charter guy, the charter captain thought was a Kenai King. This was last week. So there are some pre-runners to our king streams, and when you're out on the salt, there's always the opportunity to catch those feeder kings that are always in the Ketchumek Bay.
Well, I know you guys fish for those all winter long, and is there an up and down to that in terms of, I guess, and I guess I was wondering if the rivers are cold and the ocean is warm, maybe the ocean feeder kings will be grouping up more in the spring and more available.
Well, you know, it's different every year, Charles, and this year it's been a little spotty. But on Saturday we went out for just a couple hours and picked up an 18-pound feeder king with a couple of friends. Halibut fishing, we get our limit of halibut in an hour or so, not big ones, but, we went to a chicken hole, and it was a pretty nasty day Saturday, but we had a good time and good action there with the chicken at the chicken hole.
All right, and what about the Anchor? Is that getting started yet, or what's the story in the Anchor River?
You know, I haven't driven up there. I'm not sure. Tom might have a better, better understanding of what the conditions are there. Tom, is Deb Berwin in charge of that Anchor River sonar?
Well, right now, Deb kind of helps out advising, but Carol Kirklevic down there is the assistant area biologist running the show there. And so they are in the process of, with the water levels, when they're up higher, they use a partial weir, and then they use a sonar to gap that hole that's there until water drops low enough and they can get the weir all the way across. So they are still working on that. Yeah, this weekend is the first opener for the Anchor River.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's probably going to be a typical or even less so for the Anchor. Typically that first weekend really is, there's not a lot happening mm-hmm. on it. It's real water conditions dependent on it. And so, I would, it just go out with low expectations and you'll have a good time.
Yeah. Well, and Memorial Day is coming up in a couple of weeks. People are going to be going out there.
Well, that's traditionally, that's one of the things that I have a really hard time with. And last year in the column, every report that I had, we weren't following typical profiles of what I could base existing fishing experience from or trips, the run timing. The only thing that seems to be consistent is the return of the sockeye salmon to the Kenai. I always look at July 15th as kind of the magic date. And if you look at that bell-shaped curve that Tom was mentioning, that's kind of the sweet mm-hmm. spot. But all the other stuff, I was out west fishing the Aleutians, the fish were late, the water was really high, there's all these other conditions. I had a question actually for Jim and Tom. I've been noticing with these feeder kings that we're getting a lot of small feeder kings, and I had this conversation, I don't know if Tom knows Gary Martinick up at Paxton Lake, but Gary was telling me that we are kind of, and I don't know, because I'm speaking strictly anecdotally here, I haven't looked at the science, but one of the things is that we are running into a colder ocean climate. Is there any truth to that, Tom? He said the statistical modeling from this conference that he went with the NOAA guys is this, that we're in a 50-year cooling cycle on the ocean. I don't know if there's any truth to that, But what I have noticed, and Jim, you would know probably a lot about that because you fish for these feeder kings, they seem to be smaller. I talked to Diane Duback at Alaska Seward. Saltwater out of Seward, and the biggest fish, they had a little tournament last week, was a 9-pound feeder. I don't know if feed in the ocean is less prolific, if we're not getting, the bait fish, and, of course, the biomass to support these fish. But it seems to me, I'm speaking strictly anecdotally, Tom could probably elaborate a little bit more, but if we are in a 50-year cooling cycle and we have less bait available in the ocean, could there be a correlation between that and slower growth rates?
That's a big topic, and I want to get it, that Pacific decadal oscillation where you get warmer and cooler cycles, you get different distributions of salmon versus bottom
Absolutely,
fish and all
yeah.
that. And then there's a whole issue of like, where were the kings last year?
But across my desk at ADN, I've had a lot of pictures come from guys that have caught feeder kings. They're all small. I mean, they look like coho. I mean, normally...
Are you seeing that, Jim?
Let me tell you about, we had our winter king, our one-day winter king salmon tournament at the end of March. And the largest fish was a 36-pound fish, which is not a bad feeder. The next largest fish was at 29 pounds, and then it dropped precipitously after that. With many fish winning in the money for at 20 pounds, where last year a 20-pound fish didn't make it on the board at all. So there may be something to that, or it may be the luck of the day.
Right. Tom, any thoughts on size of salmon relative to ocean temperatures, Pacific decadal oscillation? Are you guys seeing trends for that, or is that, fishermen always see trends whether they're there or not?
Well, one thing that we have going is kicking off some king salmon studies to try to get a handle on what we're seeing with king salmon. The governor has provided $30 million to king salmon studies. But some of the things that we're looking at is, things do appear to be kind of being driven out in the ocean. Marine conditions may not be real favorable to king salmon. Yes, we do know forage fish populations are down. Seabirds that prey on them, those populations are down. Fish size, what we're seeing is fish are tending to return at a younger age. Not so much the individual age class itself is getting smaller. So say you have a fish that's 5 years old. That fish itself, the overall length of those fish aren't really decreasing very much. But fish are returning at a younger age. They're not staying out in the ocean quite as long. And we're not sure what's driving that right now. So hopefully with some of these studies that we have kicking off here in this next few years, that may help us provide some more information to have a better understanding of what's going on out in that marine environment, what's production doing versus freshwater versus marine. So that's what we're looking for.
Interesting topic. I want to talk more about that. That was Tom Vania, who was just speaking. He's the regional management biologist for Alaska Department of Fish and Game for Cook Inlet. Also with me today, Jim Rovakis on the phone from Homer, charter captain, Skookum Charters, also has a new book with his amazing photographs. There's a link to it on our website. It's called Snap Decisions. And we got some of his pictures, actually, that we stole for our website, and also some instructional videos that Jim produces on fishing techniques for various rivers on the Southern Peninsula. And they're quite good. So you can check those out. Those are linked at alaskapublic.org. Just click on the fishing forecast link. And also with us, Tony Weaver. He writes the fishing column for Anchorage Daily News. The first column of the season is up, and we've got that linked at our site as well. And Tony also has his own show talking about fishing. It airs at 7 p.m. on Thursdays at 700 a.m. and 9 a.m. Saturdays at 96.3 FM. Last but perhaps not least, Charles Wolforth, your host. It's Outdoor Explorer, and we welcome your comments or questions on our site, Facebook, Outdoor Explorer, or however you want to get involved. So we need to talk about this issue of, like, what happened to the kings last year, and fishing was so poor in the upper inlet. And and I guess it to some extent you never really know. But I was wondering, Tom, and then Jim and Tony can weigh in on this. Was there a pattern there? I mean, was it, you know, that these kings are on a, you know, a 4 or 5 year cycle, right? I mean, was it 4 or 5 years ago we had bad fishing, or is there anything like that that's obvious that you can point to about why it was bad last year?
Well, we've seen a decline in production really starting probably about 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of seemed to hit rock bottom there last year. 2010 was also not real good. It seemed like 2011 was a little bit better. But they were all certainly well below average. We had seen that in the past, kind of in the late 90s. There were some low king salmon production periods during then as well. It came out of it, and as recently as you know, from 2003 to 2006, we had some really good king salmon runs. Mm-hmm. Those were actually some very good escapements. Some of them were well above escapement goals, and the runs that came back that were a product of those large escapements is what we were seeing now from 08 until now. And so we had very poor production off of large and really extremely large escapements. So there's some of that goes on, is that, you know, there are optimum escapement levels. You don't want too few and you don't want too many. You tend to lose some production. It could be areas that are limited for spawning area, or those could be other areas that are limited for rearing areas when those fry come out and those smolter out, that there may be too much competition there and poor survival there. So there could be some of that's factoring in. But then when you have these really, like Tony was talking about, these really cold ocean temperatures and the production out in that marine environment may be also playing a very large factor. So it gets kind of difficult right now to try to pinpoint one or the mm-hmm. other. We don't have a lot of information on juvenile salmonids when they get out into the ocean in that juvenile stage where they're running along the shelves, along the coastlines and stuff mm-hmm. before they drop out into deep water. A lot of the marine studies that go on, you know, they have very large vessels and stuff, and right. they're much better at capturing fish when they get out into depth, but mm-hmm. they're not real good and haven't collected a lot of data on that nearshore environment. So we're looking to try to pool with federal agencies that tend
to
have.
So we can kind of see them when they go downstream, and we can see them when they're out at sea, but between the stream and getting all the way out there.
Yeah, but even in freshwater systems, counting smolt, counting fry, you know, you're battling ice to get mm-hmm. in there, because they're going to run as soon as ice is out, and they're heading out to ocean. Mm-hmm. So in the past, we've done projects where we're assessing smolt production and stuff. It's very labor intensive. If you tag smolt as they go out, you know, then you have to track them when they come back too, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a really long time frame for those types of projects and stuff. They do give you some really good information on freshwater production that goes on, and it gives you a better idea for the whole life cycle of different spawning classes.
Yeah, there's kind of a time lag between what science can tell us in terms of how long it takes to get answers and the information people want to know, right?
Well, it's a big detective story. I was just down in Guatemala, and then I know a lot of the guys at the Bonefish Tarpon Trust Foundation, which does a lot of satellite telemetry and a bunch of other tagging and tracking issues. One of the things that we have is that, you know, if you do have a smolt, like he was saying, how do you track that one smolt out of 2 million or 3 million smolt and get on top of the technology, or even if the technology is there? I don't really think we have the technology now, but it would be ideal, you know, if we could track those movements of the fish, so see if there are some maybe potentially intercept issues with bycatch, mm-hmm. or if it's ocean climatic stuff where we're just losing those fish out on the free range, so to speak. And, you know, one of the things I related to somebody before, I said it's almost like being in the old Wild West. You have a bunch of cattle, you let them out, and you free range them, you know. And then some of them come back, and some of them get stolen. Some of them die in the woods somewhere or whatever. And if you have a brand on them, you know, well, hey, those are my, you know, those are, you know, those are my cattle or my fish, you know. If we could get a handle on that, where, what the big mystery is once they leave the river, and, you know, that would answer a lot of questions. So I'm all about, you know, the science behind, you know, getting more information. I think more information is always better. But it's really interesting to see some of the movements of the tarpon, because we've been losing a lot of the tarpon in the Florida Keys. And, you know, they migrate up through Galveston, at the Gulf Coast, and then they disappear in Mexico. And, you know, one of the things is that they're trying to put the detective story together, but a lot of them are used for, you know, food, cat food, or low grade.
So we have some of those same interception issues here, but we.
I don't know. You know, that's one of the things is that, you know, hopefully some of the $30 million that we're getting, and you know.
Get some answers.
Yeah, we can get some answers. That's the real thing that the guys need in the deal. When I was out at the Aleutians last year, and they were doing the fin DNA stuff, the ancillary fin, where they do the fin clippings for the DNA. And I'm not really tight on this science, but and Tom, you can correct me, but that DNA basically is like a barcode, right, for that fish. Like if you go to the store and you scan a barcode, you can pretty much tell what the genetic makeup is, and if they're particular to that stream, you can say, hey, that's a Chinook from the Yukon.
Right.
You know, am I right on that, or is that kind of close?
No, you are, and you know, sometimes some of those genetic sequences are real similar, and it's just how far down into the genetic code that you want to try to get to break out stocks, and then how does it apply towards managing units as well? So
for example, one of the things that I was just telling you about the barcode and the branding. So if we use the DNA as branding for the fish, okay, say that as brand XX, whatever it is, or telomeres or whatever they use in the DNA sequencing, and that says these are all Yukon fish, they all look like this, and we see that the pollock guys are getting them, or the false pass intercept guys are getting whatever it may be, you know, we can use management tools, okay, to protect, say, those viable stocks of those fish that are going to the Yukon or the, you know, the Kobuk, wherever, you know, the Cots, you know, wherever it may be, Kenai.
So it's all piecing it together and a lot of big question marks. But from the point of view of the angler, especially somebody who's just got, a couple of weekends and the fishing is, you know, it's just going out like on the week, where am I going to go catch some fish? What were you telling people last summer, in terms of
be loose and fluid.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it was pretty like much go down the peninsula.
You know, in years before, I could say that. You know, our sockeye run really saved us this year. You know, the
great
fish,
great dip netting.
Yeah, and that's a lot of economic viability for the community. And you know, one of the things with our Parks Highway fishery, we've just been getting pounded on that because we're not seeing the returns of the kings. And
it's not worth the effort.
Yeah, and so it's been hit or miss. You know, so, you know, it's been a little bit tougher up north, and then out in western Alaska, some of the salmon returns have been real squirrely.
Really bad there, too, yeah.
Yeah, and the Kenai, you know, we kind of have a hand, you know, we know it's going to be a year of low abundance.
So that's it.
And
that,
so, you know, you can manage
this upcoming
for that.
Year for the Kenai is expected to not be a good year?
Well, the projections are that the numbers are going to be down.
For kings?
Yeah, for kings.
For kings.
Yeah, for kings.
And that's why it's catch and release only. There are emergency orders out right now that restrict, you know, all the streams north and south that and these emergency orders overseed. Are above and beyond what's in the guide, the ADFG fishing reg guide. I was just going to suggest, Charles, for viewers and the folks on the web who want to have good information up to date. There's a great website called AlaskaOutdoorJournal.com, and Gary from Soldotna runs this really good website. There's right on this front page. There's the emergency orders are laid out there. You can look according to which stream you want to fish. And he also has live, as live as he can get them, fishing reports from various streams. So I can tell you, you know, what's going on at Ship Creek in the last 5 days, up north of Anchorage and south of Anchorage. So AlaskaOutdoorJournal.com.
All right, we'll put that up on our site. So, Jim, did you see when the fishing was so poor in the upper inlet last summer, was it equally poor down in your end of the woods, or did you see people being displaced down there to find some good fishing?
I was on the saltwater most of the year. Last year, I purposely avoided the anchor. Down here, it's just referred to as the river. I had fished the year before, and it just didn't feel right to be taking kings out of the river when it was so, it was clearly, a very fragile fishery. And I just, one of those guys that likes to see, not a great catch and release fan, but I do believe in helping a river recover as best as I can if I can make a personal choice on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the tools that Fish and Game has is that they have layers of management, okay, where you can ratchet up the conservation, which is good. I know the sport fish guys are going to bitch, myself included, but you know, if we're looking at the viability of the stocks and protecting the long term. Yeah, I mean, back in the 80s, we fought hard against the introduction of hatchery steelhead into the anchor. And Alaska fly fishers actually said, hey, well, we'll just go catch and release. We'll shut it down. Let's see if we can maintain these wild stocks. And the steelhead have come through fairly well on that management program. So, you know, you can leave things alone, and they can find an equilibrium. I got a really good story about that and finding equilibrium. I was down in the South Pacific at Palmyra Island at 6 degrees north latitude. If you go straight south down the Pacific, at about 159 west, where we are, somewhere in there, you go straight down almost to the equator, 6 degrees north of the equator. There's an atoll there called Palmyra Island.
Wow, you really get around.
Yeah, well, I was doing some stuff for the Nature Conservancy down there, and I was guiding and helping some guys like the owner of Patagonia, Chouinard, and those guys how to catch bonefish. But if you saw pictures of that island from the 40s during the World War II campaign, they had basically denuded the whole island of any foliage. And I don't know whether they used Agent Orange or whether they just burn and thrash, whatever, but there was pictures of the landing strip. It's a 2-mile by 2.5-mile long island, and the island had nothing on it. It looked like just a barren airstrip. And then when I was there in the 90s, there was all this proliferation of birds and trees and unbelievable amounts of growth. If you leave things alone, they could be, you know, of course, that tropic environment grows stuff very fast. You know, I'm not using the same analogy, you know, with sequoias or big trees and stuff like that. But the thing is, if you leave it alone, Mother Nature has a healing effect.
We all have to have some patience with these.
We just have to have guys want stuff to happen in a year or 2 years, you know. So if you're in a cycle sometimes, and we had this conversation before we were on the air, or maybe we were on the air. We're talking about the 50-year cooling cycle.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it takes time.
Yeah.
You know, it takes time. And
hopefully not 50 years, but.
Yes, absolutely. Hopefully hopefully we can get there sooner than that. So.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break for a few minutes here and be back in the second half. And we're going to touch on some other options for fishing, bottom fishing and getting out of town, and maybe some fishing fantasy ideas. But right now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer calendar. Tonight at the Wilda Marston Theater in Anchorage, get ready for summer with lots of great boating ideas and trip destinations at the Knick Canoers and Kayakers meeting at 7 p.m. Meet new friends, learn safety tips, and hear more about Adventure Appetites, a new Alaska business specializing in camping meals. Accidents happen. People get hurt, sick, or lost. The temperature drops, the wind picks up, and it starts to rain. Would you know what to do? You can take a wilderness first responder course this Tuesday, May 20 at the Palmer Fox Run Lodge. Sign up or find dates for more upcoming Wilderness First Responder courses offered by the North American Outdoor Institute in Alaska. Go to, you're going to have to write this down, naoiak.org. Learn more about raised bed gardening at Russian Jack Springs Park in Anchorage on Thursday, May 23rd at 6 p.m. Information on soil warming techniques will also be included in this class. Space is limited, so contact the Anchorage Municipal Parks and Rec Department if you'd like to sign up for the raised bed gardening class on May 23rd. And we'll have links to all these events at alaskapublic.org. There's lots of stuff on our website, and you can also find about our future shows and all sorts of information. And if you want to post your own event on alaskapublic.org, just click on Community Calendar. Finally, this Saturday, May 18th, is the annual creek cleanup hosted by the Anchorage Waterways Council in partnership with the Anchorage Park Foundation. To tell us more, we have Matt Kays, Program Director of the annual creek cleanup, with us on the phone. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Charles. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. We're talking about fishing, so creek cleanup is a highly apropos topic. And I know you guys were talking about it yesterday on KSKA as well. Tell me, how do folks get involved who want to volunteer to clean up the creeks? I mean, what's the, do you need to register? Do you just need to go somewhere with a pair of gloves? How do you get involved?
Well, we try to make it as easy as possible to get a lot of folks out there cleaning up. So on Saturday morning, we're going to have 9 locations spread around the town where families or co-workers or scout troops, or church groups can go and pick up supplies and clean that stretch of creek. And then you don't have to sign up or anything. We'll have sign-in sheets at the locations where people can go and get their gloves and bags and go to get to cleaning.
You know, I don't know a year when Anchorage has been more in need of cleaning. It's just looked dreadful out there after this long winter. And I know a lot of really bizarre stuff ends up in the creeks. How much stuff do you pull out of the creeks in one of these things?
Well, it's actually kind of difficult to measure.
Right, you don't weigh it or anything, yeah.
With all the different locations that we have going, we just try to get as much as we can, and we do find some bizarre stuff. In fact, we have trash awards that we give away, so if somebody finds something really crazy in the creek, we have quite a few different awards, and this year we're giving away $25 gift cards from Moose's Tooth for a variety of categories, like strangest thing pulled from the creek, most well-traveled trash, largest hunk of junk, etc.
Okay, so what would be like an example of something strange that you have found in the past?
Well, we find all kinds of bikes. We find refrigerators, lots of really large items that people don't seem to want to take to the dump and decide to use the creek as a dump instead. So we find a wide variety of household items, unfortunately.
The psychology of that just totally escapes me. I mean, of all the things I would do with an old refrigerator, throwing it in the creek would not be one that I would think of, but...
Well, sometimes people don't recognize it as a creek and they think it's a ditch. And that's one of the things that the Waterways Council is aiming to do, is sort of bring some awareness to the creeks that we have here in town.
And we have a fish in a lot of these creeks. Is that one of the reasons you're doing this, is to keep the fish habitat in good shape?
Absolutely. Most of the streams in the Anchorage Bowl and in the municipality in general are anadromous streams that support salmon habitat. And, you know, I wouldn't want to live in a creek with a bunch of garbage bags floating down through it, you know, so I thought the fish do either.
Yeah. All right. So in terms of where and when to show up, getting on the website, it's the best way to find the site closest to you. Is that what
yeah,
I'm hearing?
That's right. Yeah, you can go to the Anchorage Waterways Council website, which is www.anchoragecreeks.org. And there's a map on the website of all the different supply sites that we'll have and all kinds of information that you might need. You can also contact me. My email address is matt@anchoragecreeks.org. And ask me any questions that you might have. And also, if you're volunteering, be sure to try to come to Cuddy Park after the cleanup from 12 to 3, where we'll have a band. The band Hot Dish is playing. We're going to have some performances from some local kids, and we'll also have a food truck rally where we've invited a bunch of food trucks to come. And if you volunteer, then you get a discount at the food truck rally, as well as an entry form for some really great prizes from sponsors like REI, Kaladi Brothers, Moose's Tooth, Alaska Wildland Adventures, and Alaska Railroad.
All right. Sounds great. So clean up in the morning and then go to the Cuddy Family Park in the afternoon for the party. And
right.
And the their website is, again, linked on ours at alaskapublic.org. Click on the Fishing Forecast show and scroll down. You'll see it under there under the calendar events. Matt Case, Program Director with the annual Creek Cleanup. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Stay with us for the second half of the show. We'll continue to talk about the 2013 Fishing Forecast when Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. If you're listening in the evening, it is a recorded rebroadcast and will not be taking phone calls. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime, download podcasts, and see what's coming up on future programs at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer on KSKA. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about fishing today. My guests are Tony Weaver. He's the ADN fishing columnist. We have Tom Venia from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game with us. And down in Homer, Jim Lervakis, who's a charter captain, photographer, I guess incoming head of the Chamber of Commerce there. Jim, we haven't talked about other kinds of fishing other than salmon too much. And I know that you don't actually do halibut charters yourself. There was a new management regime, and you weren't, I guess, didn't have the fishing record to become a continue to be a halibut charter person. But something that I've wondered about is people do fishing forecasts and say that the halibut fishing is hot or the halibut fishing is, they always seem to say it's hot. Isn't it always gets kind of the same? I mean, does it really change that much through the course of the summer?
Charles, it doesn't. It doesn't. The fish come in from deep water to feed grow. And there are typical places that you can find them throughout the summer. It's usually tidally affected. You know, if tide affects the fishing, and it can be as simple as there's a piece of structure down at 150 feet, and at one point in the tide, the fish are on one side of it. Another point of the tide, they're on the other side, and you find them consistently in the same places. This time of year, we also get a pretty good results fishing close to shore in the kelp, where halibut, I believe, Tony or Tom can correct me on this, where they're feeding on the smelt and herring run that's coming through near shore. I think it's tidally affected, and you know, the moon affects the tide.
So you want to check, you don't want to go when there's sort of a half moon and the tide ranges are not that great, because that's going to reduce the current and allow you to keep your bait down. But other than that, the timing isn't too important. True?
Yes. I think on the really big tides, it's not as good fishing because of one of the things you just talked, what you just talked about, it keeping your line on the bottom. But the halibut do like water moving. At slack tide, my impression is that they're just the bite kind of turns down a little bit. You don't do as well around slack tide, and as the water starts to move again under the boat, then it starts to pick up again.
Interesting. Now, I know there have been a lot of changes in halibut management because of concerns about the abundance and obviously always a lot of conflict or concern between sport and commercial. Has that changed the character of the industry there in Homer in terms of, is it one fish thing in place now? I can't.
No, it was still, we still have two fish. The projection is that in 2 years it'll probably be one fish. The long time, the guys that got those permits, because they have been fishing, they'd fished for, you know, at least 10 years prior to when the permitting system went into place, those guys do a good business through the summers. In the last few summers, you know, the economy dipped, their fishing bookings dropped, but in general, they have had a really good last two summers. I think this summer is going to be even better. And those guys, you know, they're in business because they know how to find fish.
They're still catching huge fish. I mean, just go down to the spit, and there's no shortage of big fish down there.
Right. Yes. Now we've got to go further and further.
Right.
That said, so the time when I want to take friends down to look for big fish, I go all the way around the corner down to the Elizabeth Islands area, the Chugach Islands area, and that includes Elizabeth. That's the mouth of Cook Inlet, or as far as the Barren Islands, which is halfway to Kodiak.
Yeah, so you need good weather, a good sized boat to do that, and so I guess the factors in choosing when you go fishing would be, you got to make your reservation without knowing what the weather's going to be like. So,
and that's always the trick.
So stock up on the seasickness remedy would be my advice.
Yeah.
It's if halibut fishing won't make you seasick, nothing will.
Exactly.
Of the things that I was just kind of interject about that is that, you know, going fishing is like a lottery ticket anyway.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And, you know, you can spend a lot of money going a lot of places, burn a lot of gas, or fly to a place or wherever you're going to go. You know, the weather is a great equalizer. So, you know, if I had to make a suggestion for anybody, give yourself enough time.
Take two or three days down there. Yeah,
so if you're planning Saturday, you know, and like we've got a good southeaster. I was just talking to Jim yesterday about the weather, and he says, yeah, it's supposed to pick up to 40 today. Well, if you're taking Friday off to go halibut fishing, it may, you know, that lottery ticket is not going to punch on Friday. But if you had like a 3 or 4 day weekend, so you have to plan accordingly, you know, do all your due diligence. I mean, it's as much as a thing of doing a little bit of research before you head out.
I think that's such good advice for any outdoor trip you're going to take in Alaska
is put
days on either side, because that's otherwise you're going to be stressed out, and that's that kind of where bad stuff happens as well, because you're going to push it.
No, you start pushing it. Yeah, you start pushing it, or you're trying to do things that you shouldn't be doing. And the thing is that this state, you know, there isn't a big margin for error, you know, for flying or running in boats or what have you.
So, Tony, if you were, obviously they're the most halibut charter boats are in Homer. I don't know, maybe Sitka or somewhere southeast. But if you could choose anywhere in Alaska to go halibut fishing, where would you choose?
Well, I have a couple of parameters. Homer's great, and where Jim goes, you know, when you start getting outside up Elizabeth and around Chugach Islands and, you know, up in the Kenai, you know, you have some really great fishing there. If you're running out and fishing one of the flats, you know, that's a great area if you want to just catch halibut. I like fishing out of Seward. Seward's really pretty to me. It's one of the prettier places, but it's very weather contingent. The best fishing is east of Cape Resurrection or down towards Ialik. And those are weather issues. So if it blows, they're going to stay inside the bay. The good thing is you know, these big, huge mountains coming out, and it's beautiful there. But you probably want to catch as many halibut as you would in Homer, you know, fishing in the bay. And then, of course, you know, Valdez, and then you have Whittier now. We have access to Whittier. The Whittier run is longer. You know, you got to get outside over into Montague and over the areas to get into the good halibut
fishing.
That's
a heck of a long way. Yeah.
Well, it's a long day. You know, I took my sister, who lives in Washington, D.C., out, and she always asked me, hey, send me some halibut when you get some. You know, so I put her a FedEx package, you know, for Christmas, send her off some smoked salmon and stuff. And so I said, you know, this halibut stuff is, you know, this stuff is kind of hard to get. It's probably about $200 a pound. I said, but I'm going to take you out with me. So I took her down to Seward. We got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock, whatever it was, to drive down, get all the gear, get on the boat, go out fishing. We get back, you know, at 6 o'clock. We're cleaning the fish. We put all the stuff up. And she was, she told me, she says, "Wow, I am beat," you know. Yeah. And I go, "Well, that's halibut fishing." So when you know, she thinks that I go outside the front door. Yeah. You know, Jim has that option because he lives in Homer. He can jump in his boat and go out and fish one of his chicken patches. But
I think those,
for the average person that's living in the city, like
there's more people doing these overnight.
The
trips,
overnight thing is
a
way to go.
Sense.
Yeah, is a way to go and give yourself some time. You know, if you go out to Chamois Bay,
costs more obviously, but
yeah. It costs a little bit more, but you look at your time and your effort, and you probably will do four or five of those trips where you miss the weather and you hit one of them. That's good.
Now, and, let me ask this, because somebody I'm sure Jim knows, Daisy Lee Bitter, told me that back in the 50s, you could go down to the city dock in Homer and catch a 100-pound halibut. Daisy's a pretty honest person. I think she's probably telling
there's
the truth.
There's some truth to that. We used to catch
crab. And now you're going farther
right
and farther.
Yeah,
you know, and I wonder if you feel that's true, you know, Jim and Tony, that we're sort of we're making a circle of no halibut around our town, so you have to keep going farther. Yeah,
I believe there's a lot of truth to that. We used to be able to catch crab and all types of stuff off the dock in Homer back in the old days, and this was in the 60s, in the late 50s, and those stocks were there. Same thing with Kodiak, and one of the things I just want. You know, I mean, if our listeners out there have context, you have to have context whenever you speak of things. Well, the fish is really good. Well, you talked a lot of the old timers there, and I've seen 300-400-pound halibut caught right outside the harbor in Seward.
Mm-hmm.
Those fish have been there. Those are really old fish.
Okay? Right.
Those have been taken out of the gene pool. Same thing with Southeast. That's the reason they're down to one fish. A lot of those old stock halibut have been depleted.
But My first summer as a charter boat captain, I spent in Ketchikan running day trips. I had 75 charters in a summer that summer. Good experience, great first year experience. and we just never found halibut anywhere within 10 or 12 miles of Ketchikan. Occasionally we could get a halibut out of Ward Cove. Most of the time we had to run 25 miles at least. And this is an open 22-foot skiff, open 20-foot skiff. So my clients were in for an exciting ride most of the time. Around Homer, the anecdotal experience I have with just having fished here for so long. My family's had a cabin on the south side of the bay for 25 years, and you know, I started coming down here in the mid 70s and built a cabin, my own cabin on the far side there first, and it's you know, the places where I used to be able to go and get my limit in an hour and a half, they just don't produce halibut anymore.
Let me turn to Tony Vanya from Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I know that halibut are not in the Fish and Game bailiwick like salmon are, but there's been issues, and we talked about it just very briefly earlier about the reduction in amount of forage fish, so the fish that the predatory fish are eating. And there's this issue with the mushy halibut that's been talked about, where, you know, halibut are caught and the flesh is not palatable, it's all mushy, and that this could be, as I understand it, a nutrition issue. You know, I'll let you, however you want to weigh in on this, but is there an ecosystem issue in the inlet, do you think, in terms of the abundance of fish and of the food that's available to fish?
Well, I was afraid you're going to ask me that, because I was thinking to myself, I probably should have reread some of those emails that I came across my computer that talked about mushy halibut and chalky halibut. So I can't remember exactly kind of some of the conditions that are surrounding those. Again, you're right. Halibut are federally managed. It's not in my wheelhouse. Right now I'm focused on kings and the start of the season here. But halibut are like any other fish. They're gonna go where the food is. They can travel, pretty good distances looking for food, you know. So if that food source isn't there, they're not going to be there. The demand for the resource, all these fish resources, isn't declining. You know, demand is ever increasing. And so when you talk about what it, things used to be as to what things are now and what things may be in the future, you know, you just, you have to continue to plan and manage for sustainability of those resources with that ever-decreasing demand. You know,
that's a really good concept.
They want, you know, that demand isn't going away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, king salmon, we have poor production. We have fewer of them coming back right now. The demand for that hasn't gone away. So how do you balance that? Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. And that's what we're dealing
with.
That's
why you have a tough job. Well, as we look at, we've talked a bit about kings on a low trend, and we presumably this is not predicted to be a great year. Can you talk briefly about silvers and reds? What's expected this coming summer for them?
Well, for the Cook Inlet sockeye, I believe the forecast is a little over 6 million, 4.3 of that bound for the Kenai and the rest of it to the other areas within Cook Inlet. So I believe that's just, it's above average.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, so it is looking good for sockeye.
Great.
Coho's a little more difficult. We don't have as much understanding of coho. They're highly variable in mm-hmm. in runs. You can have very good escapements produce poor returns, and you can have poor returns produce good escapements, and it runs the gamut. And coho salmon runs are very long, very protracted. They go, you know, well into the fall, and we all know how nice the weather is in Alaska mm-hmm. in the fall. So trying to keep assessment projects in the water to count coho is extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you're going to be counting them into November, into December, too.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you can't do it. I mean, you can index
mm-hmm.
Runs as they come in, count portions of that. And if you get an understanding on that index, does it apply towards abundance from year to year to year? But again, coho too is, you can have a fantastic escapement. It can be lousy fishing because what do they do, Tony? They hold up the mouth of the river, wait for rain.
There you go.
You have a little bit of rain. They storm the gates, they storm the weir, and you have 10,000 coho pass the weir in one day.
Right.
That doesn't make for great fishing, but you know, it does uh-huh. sustain the run and stuff. So coho's a little tougher to deal uh-huh. with.
And great ocean fishery yeah. out of Seward. I mean, that's kind uh-huh. of their bread and butter down
yeah,
there.
One yeah, one of the things that Tom mentioned on is the demand hasn't decreased. So, mm-hmm. you know, the thing is most anglers, you know, they don't have context or perspective over a long piece of distribution and data that, you know, we have on these fish. Alex Boris said something really great. He wrote a column in the paper about all the moose hunters on the peninsula hunting for these moose, and they're all saying that the moose are all gone. No, there's just like 100,000 more guys that are hunting these moose. And the production, okay, in this ranch, this moose ranch, let's call it a moose ranch because that's what it is. It has a sustainability of, you know, say 150 prime bulls that can be harvested out of the area. But everybody wants them to have 900 trophy moose. It's a closed ecosystem, okay?
Right.
It's kind of like the Steve Jobs thing. You know, it's a closed system, okay, with a maximum amount of yield and sustainability, and the demand is increasing,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I know Bob Begich, one of the things that these guys get constantly is that the demand is that there's this satiation for more and more and more.
Give us more fish, right.
You know, and then the deal is that, no, let's manage what we got so we can have sustainability over right. long term.
We've learned the ecosystem is only so large. You can't...
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't have an infinite...
Not infinite right.
It's not infinite. So, you know, if you can keep that into perspective and look at these things as a cyclical thing, you know, you can at least get your head around it a little bit.
Well, I hear you. Now, we've just got a few minutes left, and I promise that we're going to talk about sort of fishing fantasies. What is the best fishing experience that, okay, so a guy in Anchorage is saying, I'm going to blow my money this summer on the best possible fishing experience I can have in our region, or maybe I'll let you go statewide. Tony, do you want to share what
you want to do saltwater or you want to do freshwater?
Just whatever, let's make it Tony's fishing. Like, what would you do?
For Alaska, okay.
Yeah.
One of my dream trips is fishing Cape St. Elias, south of Cordova. I've been there once.
It's so beautiful out there.
Yeah, well, they got the lighthouse there. All the food from the Gulf and where they mix there, it's like a mixing point. I've been there and fished it before, and then we had weather, and then I got back in there. We had short windows, but that's a fantasy trip for me. And, of course, Western Alaska, anywhere in Western Alaska, particularly float trips for trout's great.
Yeah. How do you arrange a float trip out in Western Alaska?
Well, you know, most of the air carriers out there can accommodate you if you want to do a self-guided trip, whether it's the Kinectoc, the Kizaralik, the Alagnak, whatever it may be. I mean, you owe yourself to do one of those trips because you're going to see bears. You're going to see a lot of wildlife. You're going to see, you know, areas that don't have a lot of impact, you know, from people off the road system and what have you. So
that's
you can call the air carriers. You know, there's Freshwater Adventures out of Dillingham. There's Iliamna Air. They do a lot of stuff. Even Doug down in North Kenai at Alaska West does some stuff across the inlet, which is shorter for a lot of guys, and they can get over there and see some of the stuff that's available.
Let me give Jim a chance to answer the same question.
Okay, well, you know, I've heard about this, and my understanding is that the nexus for king salmon into the state, that the best king salmon run traditionally is in Sitka, and a certain particular week in June, and that's where I'd like to. That's one of my fantasy trips.
Well, you could do it. Not impossible.
Let's do it.
All right, guys. Let's throw some money in the pot. And I don't know, Tom, if you want to weigh in on that. You're probably too busy counting fish.
He's up there putting in a weir.
Yeah, that's right.
No. Well, I know just here, just within the Anchorage area, you know, with our new William Jack Hernandez hatchery, you know, we're providing diversity and fishing opportunity by all our stock lake programs. You know, out in the valley, we're stocking nearly 80 lakes down on the Kenai Peninsula. We've got another 20, 30 lakes there. All the Anchorage lakes are being stocked, having a great product that we're putting out there, some really nice rainbow trout. And so
you don't have to go that far.
You don't have to go that far.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, guys. This has been really fun, and I hope listeners enjoyed it. And I've had three guests with me today. Tom Vanya, you just heard from. He's with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Jim Rovakis was with us from Homer. He's a charter captain, Skookum Charters. He has a book, Snap Decisions, both of those linked on our website. And he's also apparently now going to be head of the Homer Chamber of Commerce. Tony Weaver was with us in the studio. Tony does the Anchorage Daily News fishing column. He has also broadcasts on 700 AM, 7 PM on Thursdays, and 96.3 FM, 9 AM on Saturdays. And Matt Kays was with us earlier. I probably figured out Charles Wolforth. Next week on Outdoor Explorer, we'll be talking about clamming, just in time for folks to pack up for the Memorial Day weekend on the Kenai Peninsula. The tides over Memorial weekend will be enormous. Perfect clamming conditions with plenty of time and access to the lower intertidal zone. But there are some issues with razor clamming at Clam Gulch and along that stretch of coast, with abundances down by 50% or more. We'll be talking with a scientist who's studying the issue and happens to have grown up a clammer from Homer, and also a health guy who spends his time clamming. And we'll talk about those health issues and how to do it. Do you like clamming? Do you like the bigger clams or the little steamers? Any secrets of how you like to catch a razor clam? What's the best way to cook them? And you worried about PSP? We'll be talking about that too. Let us know on Facebook at Outdoor Explorer as we build the show. You can weigh in on our other upcoming shows too. We'll be talking about sea kayaking on May 30 and single track bike trails on June 6. That's all for today on Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Our producer and web editor is Kristen Speck. Thanks for joining us, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.